got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here with you as always. What's going on, Kevin?
Oh, just having a happy day building a new chicken coop.
See, I never have cool stories like that, dude. It's always like, well, I'm going to mow my lawn tomorrow and then maybe have some lemonade and watch Netflix. And you're like, yeah, I'm dipping chickens in insecticide and I'm building chicken coops.
Oh, you need more poultry in your life.
Doesn't everyone? I feel like everybody needs a little more poultry in their lives.
That's my bumper sticker.
Yeah, I'm going to make those up. That's our first merch here at Science Facts and Fallacies.
Yeah, oh man. It would be the lamest swag to match the podcast.
it'd be hipster though. It would be like, yeah. Oh, this is so stupid that it's cool, you know, yeah. And everyone would buy it. Anyways, let's talk science and stop making stupid poultry jokes. So, it's ridiculous. Anyways, guys, so first up, Europe has suspended some of its GMO regulations so it can fast track a COVID-19 vaccine. We talked a little bit about this last week, but we're going to dive into what a double standard this is for Europe. And then next up, low-carb diets might help treat Alzheimer's, ALS, and even cancer. But how much do we know? We're going to look at the evidence and see how conclusive it is at this point. And then finally, we're going to take a look at how our genetics may influence our response to COVID-19. It's all kinds of variables that might influence how sick you get or whether you even get sick. So we'll dive into that as well. But Kevin, first up, let's talk about the European Union and what seems to me like just a blatant double standard on GMOs here.
Yeah, I think that's how the Center for the Consumer Choice Center in, I believe it's in Ireland, how they labeled it an inexplicable double standard, using that good Irish word, inexplicable. This was in the European Union suspends GMO regulations to fast track a COVID-19 vaccine by Sylvester Phelan in Agriland, which is an Irish publication. And this article really just highlights what has really been banging around in the news lately, whether it's on, you know, popular press or elsewhere, that the EU has such stringent rules saying that we follow these precautionary guidelines and everything must be thoroughly tested and we can't have any undue risk and long-term effects and all this stuff when it comes to agriculture and genetic engineering. But here they are in a situation where they're now accelerating new vaccines that are genetically engineered microbes to clinical trials. So it runs contrary to that entire precautionary principle, that this idea that we're going to go slow and methodically and never do anything if we have other ways to do it. And here they're saying full speed ahead. So kudos to them, but at the same time, a little hypocrisy here, guys.
And what's funny about it, and this is how you know it's a political issue, is they obviously understand risk and they understand trade-off when it comes to an issue like a pandemic. And so they put aside all these concerns, as you were saying. But then in the press release that the EU Parliament released, they specifically said this doesn't go beyond vaccines. So those two things together tell me they know exactly what's going on. And you know, when they do restrict GMOs, it's politically motivated.
Right. And what it really is that they see how not having a vaccine, or if they get beat to vaccines by US and China companies, they will have a significant way to catch up. You know, they see that, you know, their own companies are going to be way behind and technology will be way behind. And studies in EU will be very behind. And they see the writing on the wall with that. So there's an economic angle. And so it's also a follow the money issue too.
Absolutely. And another thing I just thought of, the usual suspects, you know, all of these different green groups and anti-GMO groups that are based in Europe, as far as I can tell, they haven't said anything about this issue. They haven't complained. They haven't said this is going to put people at risk. So I think even they know that it would be unwise to challenge the use of genetic engineering in this case. So that's just a fascinating aside for people to keep in mind.
Now, the other interesting aside on this is that if you actually read the regulation, they go back into the they go back to say that the medicinal products that are for use in humans consisting of genetically engineered materials to treat or prevent COVID-19 must be administered swiftly in the absence of prior environmental risk assessment or under consent of blah, 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 blah. So they're saying that even with all of the concerns we have, we're just going to push this through. And I don't know how to feel about this. I feel like maybe they've taken a step in the right direction, that they've woken up and smelled the coffee. They see that, you know, here's technology, let's use it to solve problems for people. Great. But at the same time, I kind of feel like they shouldn't, like someone has to kind of call the BS on this, because the same people who are now advancing this for medicinal use, you know, what would be a much more risky context. You know, in other words, if your carrot has a change in a single base of DNA, single letter of DNA to make it more nutritious, that's forbidden. But if you genetically engineer some organism to make an antibody that now you can inject into a patient with very little, you know, animal testing and everything before, this is perfectly acceptable. So it's the old hypocrisy again.
Yeah. Well, and the funniest part is that the European Food Safety Authority, which is sort of like our FDA, they don't have any regulatory power, I don't think, but Europe imports tons and tons of genetically engineered crops as animal feed. And so everyone that gets approved for import has to be very thoroughly tested by the EFSA. And they, and we post these on GLP because it's funny to watch it develop, but they have consistently said over and over that every biotech crop that the US grows doesn't pose a risk to the environment, doesn't pose a risk to human health. And so all that to say, they have all of this data built up about biotech crops. And so it's even goofier in that sense, because they're moving ahead with vaccines, as they probably should, with limited information, as you said, but they have tons of studies that they pay for showing that these are safe. So that's just there's so many little nuggets of wisdom here for people to keep in mind.
Well, the big take home message is, and this is like the cohesive message of our time, right? Is let's let the science do the talking and trust the researchers and not the politicians. And if it, whether it's a COVID vaccine, whether it's a new line of corn, a new type of soybean, a potato for Ireland, you know, when I was in Northern Ireland a few years ago, I got to speak with Parliament up in Strathclyde, and there were so many really outstanding parliamentarians who were scientists or farmers who said, you know, they take me aside and say, I can't convince these people of nothing, you know. And they were a little bit hot about it because they did the work and they understand the science. So it's one of these issues where maybe this is the thing that will crack the door to a much more sober discussion about the technology as it applies to plants.
Well, here's hoping. But in the meantime, Kevin, let's talk about low-carb diets and preventing disease, or maybe treating disease, I should say.
Yeah, interesting stuff. And this comes from an article from Ingrid Splide in Science Nordique, July 16th of this year. I was just flipping through the pages of Science Nordique the other day. And they talk about the potential for low-carb diets to treat various diseases. And the article is a little bit all over the board because it takes on a lot. And it doesn't have a lot of definitive, hard evidence that's presented, but it does have some. And the main star of the show is a what they say researcher and clinical nutritionist, Magnalide Kaverland, And she works at Oslo University Hospital, and her area of research is epilepsy. And epilepsy has a very good track record with keto. So keto diets being these diets that are rich in fats and proteins, very low in carbohydrates. And the idea is that it changes the body's metabolism away from glucose metabolism and towards fat metabolism or towards protein metabolism, but mostly fat metabolism, beta oxidation and other types of metabolic processes that change the access to the metabolites that are necessary for metabolism, or, you know, for making life happen, you know, for making energy. And they know for sure that ketogenic diets, and this has been stuff I've looked at for a while, there are certain metabolic diseases such as like glucose transporter protein disease, pyruvate dehydrogenase deficiency. These are metabolic diseases from rare genetic changes where ketogenic diets are really beneficial. And people do show very strong responses. And this is because their bodies are impaired in glucose metabolism. So obviously, giving a different way for the body to metabolize food or produce energy from metabolites it can use makes some sense. And just to kind of real quick talk about some of the old data, going back to the 1920s, a fasting and ketogenic diet was actually one of the preferred treatments for epilepsy. And what they were able to show is that in a significant portion of epileptic patients, they were able to decrease the severity or the frequency of seizures by using this kind of diet strategy. In other ones, it made it worse, but in a large number, it made them better. And maybe the most well-known case is Jim Abrams, the guy who's one of the writers of Airplane and Naked Gun, some of the best movies of all time. Top secret.
Yeah, they are. I didn't know that. Fun fact. Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah. Kentucky Fried Movie, which if you haven't seen Kentucky Fried Movie, you know, Top Secret didn't age very well, but Airplane, it's funny how they all, you know, but, anyway, Jim Abrams, he had a son who was having hundreds of seizures a day. And when you've got a child that lives a life just from seizure to seizure, you go for any kind of treatment you can go for. And I think this is the story that when he had his child at a hospital for treatment of epilepsy using conventional therapies and drugs, he was reading in the library about ketogenic diets. And he took his kid home and changed the diet. And the kid was almost, I think his child's name was Christopher, was almost completely cured of seizures, and severity and everything went away. And so this had huge effects for him. So that was a really well-known case where when we talk about epilepsy and seizures, that kind of thing, where, and then there have been randomized controlled studies that also show some positive effects.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that aspect of it, because what I've noticed, and I think you mentioned this at one point on one of these shows, Kevin, but I did really well on a low carb diet. I lost a lot of weight and all of my, you know, my health markers improved. But what I've seen with weight loss and with even with some of these issues we're talking about, some of these disorders, people do really well and they respond well to the diet, whereas other people, they either don't respond to it or they get worse. And that underscores to me why it's so hard for science to suss out what's going on here, because there's just so many variables. And even in a good clinical trial, you can't account for all of them. You just might not even be aware of all of them. So let's talk about some of these studies that they're doing and what they actually show.
Well, you're right on. When you look at a cross-section of a clinical trial, you try very hard to survey a large and diverse group of people, right? And when you do that, you kind of dilute out the effects that may be very profound in one segment of that group and not in others. And so that takes a much deeper level of testing and larger numbers to be able to really separate out those individual segments, meaning people that maybe are genetically predisposed to this kind of thing working and those that aren't. And so that's a really important part of this. I know that for me, I could do this low carb thing, and it works like a charm. I can lose weight. I can feel a little more energy in the afternoon, you know, that kind of thing. But I have a hard time avoiding carbohydrates because beer and bread are like two of the best things ever. but there's a lot of good, there's a lot of very good indications of where there has been, you know, when you look at a variety of different diseases, that absolutely metabolic diseases that 100% appear to have a very strong association with good outcomes after a ketogenic diet. And there's no question about that, but it's not necessarily for everyone about every single kind of disease. That's the big deal.
Right, right. Well, and I think one thing, another thing this underscores is that diet can have profound effects on your health. And I, at least my perception is in the scientific community that tends to get downplayed sometimes because you have the alternative health people, let's call them that for now, who will say, you know, if you change your diet, you're going to grow 2 feet taller and you'll be more beautiful and everything about your life's going to improve. And so you get the scientists who try to temper that and they say, well, hold on, you know, you need to slow down and actually provide some evidence for that. And so you can actually overlook the real effects and the real significance of diet when you have this back and forth going on. What do you think about that?
Well, that makes sense. And that's because everyone is genetically distinct. And, you know, unless you're an identical twin and, you know, the genetic deck that you're playing with defines your metabolism and your sensitivity to carbohydrates or your ability to use whatever metabolite. And that's why this is such an important concept, is because for some people, this will have profound effects. They know that ketone bodies, which are really the byproducts of fatty acid oxidation in the mitochondria, they absolutely do have an effect in as an anticonvulsant in some patients. That's very well established, and they know why, you know, mechanistically, and this from animal studies in mice all the way up to humans. But it says that you have to look at these things, not to dismiss them when people make a claim, but to look at them look at them very carefully and think about the genetic overlays. That's what's most important.
Sure. Well, and let's keep on that theme. So let's talk about how our genetics can influence our response to coronavirus, because that seems actually nice lead in, because it's more or less the same topic. So tell us about this next story, Kevin.
Well, that was my rationale when we were thinking about the stories to cover this week, is because these two things are very similar. In one case, you're talking about metabolism with respect to disease and other health outcomes. The other one, you're talking about genetic variants that really affect your susceptibility to the symptoms of a viral infection. And this comes from Josh Rappaport, who wrote for GLP, "In Your Genes, DNA Holds Clues About How You'll Fare with Coronavirus." And it talks about the emerging role of association genetics and disease, in this case, susceptibility to coronavirus symptoms. And what's important to remember is that a lot of times when we get a bacterial or, you know, fungal or even viral, you know, infection going, a lot of what's happening are symptoms that are a result of the direct result of the bacteria or, you know, whatever toxins that are produced or things that are produced. In the case of COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2, the virus SARS-CoV-2, you're talking about ways it affects people differently. And on this podcast, we've talked about lungs. We've talked about, you know, finding it in feces. We talked about all the different things that this virus can do. And a lot of those viral manifestations have to do directly with genetics. You know, what is your susceptibility? Where do you produce the most of the receptors that the virus uses to recognize the cell? That varies from person to person. It varies from organ to organ, from person to person. So these are some of the things that are being investigated. And now scientists have really used this opportunity of the COVID-19, you know, pandemic to start to look at the genetic associations between severity of illness and specific genetic determinants.
He actually has a quote at the beginning of the story. I think it really appropriately sums up what we were just talking about, which is how complex this is. And so he says, most human diseases with a genetic component are like driving off-road in an aging car with worn-out shocks and bald, underinflated tires that are out of alignment. Something will eventually go wrong due to multiple potential sources of failure placed in the context of particular environmental stresses. So what he seems to be saying is, you know, those are all these genetic components, and then, you know, where you're driving or where you exist or whatever affects you in your environment, that's another layer on top of it. And so it's up to people like you, I mean, you're a plant scientist, but it's up to geneticists to suss out all these different components and figure out what's going on. So just to give people a sense of scale, it's not a matter of, oh, here's this one gene and it causes this one disease and boom, there we go, you know, problem solved. So weigh in on that if you would.
No, that's exactly right. It's really a polygenic trait. You're looking at someone's symptom spectrum in response to the virus based upon an entire set of different genetic variants that maybe contribute to the ability to affect the symptoms associated with the viral infection. And then maybe it helps to think of it like that, that this is just a virus that moves into the body. The body tries to combat that virus, but there's going to be different effects on different organ systems and different responses that happen throughout the body. And if you've been dealt a genetic hand that allows this virus to efficiently dock and do its thing and maybe not mount the best immune response to it, you may find yourself in a catastrophic infection state. And this on top of, you know, and there have been people who, healthy 30-year-old soccer players, you know, who never were sick a day in their lives, who dropped dead from this thing. Little kids who are now affected by the disease. So the genetic variants can't be ignored. And what's really cool is that there actually is something called the COVID human genetic effort, where they're actually looking at the genetic variants that are associated with the disease and the disease severity. And there's actually some stuff that's in preprint right now where there are 68 genes that seem to be associated with severe COVID symptoms. So you should be able to get a blood test, basically, a quick DNA sequencing of your genome, and they should be able to tell you whether or not you are at risk for severe symptoms. And that may happen within the next few months.
And to build on that, he talks about genome-wide association studies, Kevin. So what are those for people who aren't aware, and how do they work, and why are they potentially significant in the context of this pandemic?
Okay, so genome-wide association studies, or GWAS. Okay, what this means is if you take all the DNA in your body and get it sequenced, and other people get all the DNA in their genome sequenced, and you have all these databases of just letters of DNA, you know, 23 chromosomes, all the DNA that's there. Now, you say, what are the diseases that you have had, or maybe the diseases your family has had, that kind of thing. And what they do is they take the incidence of disease and they take that and statistically compare against the DNA sequence. And they say, well, everybody who seems to get the shakes from coffee has a G here in this part of the gene instead of an A, or people who are susceptible to coronavirus or the most severe symptoms in this area of the genome have a few variations in this little cluster of genes that the ones who don't have severity, they don't have that. So genome-wide association just means what are the coincidences? What are the genetic differences, the changes in the letters of DNA that coincide with a given state, whether it's susceptibility to COVID, shakes from coffee, hairy knuckles, you know, all the things that we look at. I don't look at hairy knuckles. I mean, you know what I mean. Genetics. It's not like I'm like checking you out, you know. there's a ring in there somewhere.
Oh boy.
No. The point is that you're developing associations between DNA sequence and a given trait. And it doesn't mean that DNA difference causes the trait. It just says that if you have that difference, you may be more likely to have the trait. So it means in the same genetic neighborhood of that difference. And so this has been a really powerful way of learning about human disease and breeding plants and all the things we do, because sequencing is so cheap. You can start to finally get an entire genome scan of somebody's genome very inexpensively. And that helps us build these associations.
So in the context of the pandemic, we may be able to say, if you have this particular genetic makeup, you're more susceptible. So, you know, you need to be isolated, or, you know, we need to target you with this treatment because your genetics suggest you'll respond well to it. And so in the context of healthcare more broadly, and of course with this disease, that's the significance of this. It's just fine tuning our response. Is that right?
That's exactly it. It's personalized medicine. It's saying in the context of the pandemic, we tested all your markers and you show that you will have limited susceptibility to COVID based on your genetics. And so you go teach the class this fall. And if you get sick, we're going to use this therapy instead of this one. You know, this is what we're talking about, is using our genetics that define, you know, who we are and how we responded to a viral threat or a therapeutic opportunity, and knowing that going into a situation. That's pretty cool to know that.
Yeah, it's incredible. And by the way, let me mention, Josh Rappaport just released a book. It's called Mapping Humanity, and it's all about this research we're talking about, but way beyond just medicine. So he talks about personalized medicine, but he talks about ancestry, and he talks about some of the more prickly political issues in a sensitive and a thoughtful way. And the idea is just to get people thinking about this, because, and again, we've talked about this a bunch too, Kevin, as time goes on, this technology is really going to transform a lot of things about life that most people haven't thought about. So I highly recommend his book. I'm actually going to publish an interview that we did with him a couple weeks back. So check out that book, definitely, because it's very interesting. But
that's good. Well, yeah. I should plug Alan McEwen's book too. Alan McEwen is a scientist who's been really at the forefront of the public discussion about biotechnology. And he just recently published a book called, it's sitting here. I got to look at it. Hang on.
That's okay. He's going to look at it.
DNA Demystified. And DNA Demystified is a really big, thick book, which is what it takes to demystify DNA. But that one too also talks a lot about the ancestry stuff and personalized genomics and all that good stuff. So very cool that these kinds of resources are now being available.
Check them out. Look at you guys getting book recommendations and all kinds of fun science news. I think we're doing a great public service, Kevin. So
yeah, and we did. We didn't get paid for that, by the way.
Yeah. If either of those authors want to cut us a check for new Ferraris, then you just let us know.
I'll take an old Ferrari.
Or a Datsun. I want a Datsun. Those are.
I love the old Datsuns. Are you kidding me? I used to have a B210.
Yeah, you did. That's amazing. I just want an old beat up pickup, I think. Anyways, what's going on with Talking Biotech in the next week or so, Kevin?
Oh, so cool. So this week, or the current episode of Talking Biotech is with Dr. Toby Bradshaw. And Dr. Toby Bradshaw was a scientist who had his office firebombed by the Earth Liberation Front back in 2001. And it really marked a low point in the battle against genetic engineering, because they destroyed a $2 million facility. And you got to check this interview out. I don't want to hit the spoilers, but basically Earth Liberation Front killed all of the rare collections of restoration ecology. it basically all the things they didn't want to do, they did. And, right. and it just is one of those stories that, misplace activism and how it actually does more harm to the important aspects of science than good. So really worth checking out.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who don't appreciate irony that we're talking about this week, you know, in the name of preserving nature, we're going to blow it up.
Yeah, no, actually, it's a really good theme for today is irony, because whether you're talking about the European Union bending their rules or people rethinking diet and how it relates to things. And, you know, there's a lot of very interesting angles on that. And so, you know, these kinds of discussions will become more and more prevalent as we really do start to focus ourselves on, you know, what is real and what isn't in science. And then this podcast, I hope, contributes to that a little bit.
Right on. All right, guys. Well, check out the episode. It's going to be at geneticliteracyproject.org. And you can follow us on Twitter @KevinFolta @CamJEnglish. And we will see you next week.